Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Okay, so today let's unpack a novel that really gets under your skin. It uses, well, the quietest act of refusal imaginable to launch this fierce critique of conformity and control. We're talking about Han Kang's internationally acclaimed novel, The Vegetarian, or Taisik Juija. It picked up the Man Booker International Prize back in 2016, and it's one of those books that seems quite sparse on the surface, but wow, it carries enormous emotional weight. And I think to really get into the psychological landscape Han Kang maps out, we need to ground the author a bit first. Han Kang was born in Gwangju, South Korea, and that city is defined by the really traumatic 1980 uprising, a moment of just intense collective violence and brutal suppression by the state. So this background, it definitely informs her exploration of violence, right? Not just the big state-level kind, but also how that collective trauma can sort of trickle down, manifest privately as psychological wounds, even domestic brutality.
Yeah, absolutely. So our mission today really is to dive deep into this text. We want to frame it not just as a novel about, you know, dietary choices, because it's really not about that, is it?
Exactly.
It's more like a terrifying study of autonomy, of absolute resistance, and the really destructive consequences when someone tries to purge the violence of the world from their own body.
And that resistance kicks off with the protagonist, Young Hai, and how she's introduced is so important. Initially, she's almost defined by her lack of identity. Her husband, you see, describes her as completely unremarkable, passive, just living this oppressively ordinary marriage in Seoul. She's the ultimate adapter, the picture of compliance, really.
The quiet wife.
Precisely. And the break doesn't come from some conscious intellectual decision. It comes from a dream, a terrifying, blood-soaked dream. She's haunted by these incredibly graphic images of animal slaughter, you know, flesh, gore, this primal violence. And that triggers an abrupt, totally non-negotiable decision. She's becoming a vegetarian.
Just like that.
Just like that. And this quiet refusal of meat, which is, let's face it, central to the conventional human diet, it becomes her only available way out. Her desperate quest, really, for innocence and escape from the violence she now sees is just intrinsic to being human.
And the real genius here, I think, is how Han Kang structures it. She deliberately refuses to let us directly into Young Hai's mind. The story is fragmented, broken into this triptych, three distinct parts, each narrated by a different person close to her. Mm. And that structural choice is, well, it's a huge thematic statement in itself, isn't it? It deliberately makes Young Hai this enigmatic, silent center. She becomes an object defined only by other people's biased projections, their desires, their fears. So you, the reader, you're forced to piece together her sanity, or maybe lack thereof, entirely through these distorted lenses.
And the first lens we get is her husband's, Mr. Cheom. His section is called, appropriately enough, The Vegetarian. And he just embodies this kind of banal patriarchal mediocrity. He didn't marry her for love or any real connection. He explicitly chose her because she was average, passive, because she wouldn't disrupt his orderly, comfortable, middle-class life.
So her vegetarianism, for him, it's not a belief system or a personal choice.
Not at all. It's just an inconvenience, a major inconvenience, actually, and a source of profound social embarrassment for him.
Right. It upsets the social script.
Completely. And the tension just builds and builds. It moves from his sort of mild disgust to confusion to, to outright violence. His orderly world is crumbling because his wife refuses to play her part, to follow the most basic social rules. And this all culminates at this horrific family dinner where her father, who sounds quite authoritarian, tries to physically force a piece of pork into her mouth. It's brutal.
In that incident, the father's violence, it feels like it directly parallels that state violence we mentioned earlier, the kind Han Kang grew up near. But here the consequence is intensely personal, private. Right. And in this truly arresting moment of defiance, Young Hai doesn't just resist passively. She grabs a fruit knife and slits her own wrist, calmly stating she would rather die than submit.
It's shocking. A complete rupture.
And that action, it's more than just a plot point, right? It feels like the novel's core statement on bodily autonomy. She's performing this ultimate negative agency. She chooses self-inflicted violence over allowing society represented by her father, her husband, to control her physical self, what she ingests, preferring self-destruction to being forced. Mm-hmm. Is Han Kang suggesting that maybe for the utterly powerless, absolute resistance sometimes only manifests through self-harm? It's a disturbing thought.
It is. And that's exactly the question that kind of hangs in the air as we pivot into part two. Mongolian Mark. Right. So if part one explored the violence of, let's say, institutional and domestic control, part two asks this profoundly unsettling question. How can that kind of radical, even self-destructive rebellion be well, be aestheticized
yeah.
and then exploited. We shift perspective now to the brother-in-law. He's a video artist married to Young Hai's sister In-hai, and he's struggling creatively, looking for inspiration.
Yeah, and he sees Young Hai's deepening detachment, her withdrawal, not as mental illness, but as something else entirely. He sees it as transgressive beauty, even a kind of primal, non-human purity.
He romanticizes her condition.
Completely. And his obsession fixes on this faint, flower-like Mongolian birthmark on her body. It's just a small patch of color, but for him it becomes this potent symbol of her untamed nature, of something existing outside the conventional social order. So he develops this art project around it. He wants to capture this purity. He ends up painting vibrant flowers all over her naked body, filming the act.
Okay.
And then orchestrating a subsequent sexual encounter. And he intellectualizes this whole thing, calling it a union of two floral non-human beings.
Wait, hold on. Because on one level, isn't the brother-in-law theoretically the one who comes closest to appreciating her distance from humanity, her rejection of it? Where exactly is the line here between artistic appreciation of her refusal and... well, the ultimate exploitation of her vulnerability.
That is the deep, disturbing irony, isn't it? He believes he's recognizing and celebrating her freedom, her escape. Yet his actions are arguably the most profound violation in the entire novel. He turns her body, herself, into a silent, passive canvas, an object purely for his own artistic and, frankly, sexual gratification.
So his artistic framework, his pursuit of non-human beauty...
it's just a sophisticated cover.
Yeah.
A veneer masking fundamental objectification and abuse. She escapes the husband's kind of banal control, only to fall prey to the artist's aesthetic consumption. It's a different kind of violation, but just as damaging.
And the result is just profound ruin for her. When In-hai, the sister, discovers what happened, it leads to the collapse of their marriage, the brother-in-law and In-hai's. Mm. And critically, it leads directly to Young-hai being committed to a psychiatric hospital. So the system, whether it's domestic, artistic, or now medical, it just continually refuses to grant her any genuine agency or understanding. And this brings us quite mournfully, really, to the final part, Flaming Trees. And this time it's narrated by In-hai, the sister.
Now, In-hai is perhaps the character we can most easily relate to, in a way. She's the dutiful, long-suffering older sister, the one who chose adaptation, you know, strenuous duty, over outright resistance.
As a survivor.
Yes, the survivor. She's now divorced herself, struggling to manage a cosmetic shop, and she's burdened with the catastrophic care of Young-hai, who's deteriorating rapidly.
And Young-hai's physical state in this part is just, it's heartbreaking to read. She's moved way beyond simple vegetarianism now. It's a total rejection of all sustenance. She's emaciated, skeletal, and she's convinced she is literally transforming into a tree.
A tree.
Yes. Surviving only on sunlight and water, she says. She even attempts handstands because she believes her arms are roots, trying to seek purchase in the earth. It's her final, ultimate flight into passive innocence, achieving a state where she is truly sessile, nonviolent, completely harmless.
Wow. And In-hai's perspective really forces us, the readers, to confront the true cost of both paths, compliance and radical freedom. She visits her sister in this secluded mountain asylum, and she witnesses the horrific violence of force feeding, a brutal medical intervention that tragically echoes their father's earlier, more localized violence with the pork.
It's a devastating parallel. And this is where the novel just masterfully blurs the lines between what we call sanity and madness. Is Young-hai's complete rejection of the human animal, of eating, of participating, is truly insane? Or could it be seen as a logical, albeit self-destructive, response to the inescapable violence inherent in the human condition itself?
Mm-hmm.
And In-hai, the pragmatist, the adapter, she's forced to confront the potential emptiness of her own life, her life of strenuous duty, of constant compromise. Did she choose right? And there's that one scene that just crystallizes this terrifying ambiguity. A nurse, utterly frustrated by Young-hai's passive resistance to staying alive, turns to In-hai and asks, almost casually, why is it such a bad thing to die?
Yeah.
Such a shocking question.
It completely flips the moral framework, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It implies that perhaps Young-hai's total refusal to participate is, in some dark way, the most rational act of all in a violent world.
The novel doesn't give us easy answers. It concludes with this deep sense of ambiguity. In-hai is accompanying her sister in an ambulance, transferring her to yet another hospital. And her own grip on the reality she chose, the reality of duty and survival, it seems to be fraying. But in that moment, looking out at the dark, dense forest they're driving through, she finally seems to recognize her sister's extreme behavior not just as failure or madness, as a form of powerful, silent communication, a protest so total, so absolute, that it required self-annihilation to be fully expressed.
So thinking about the literary craft again, that triptych structure we talked about is just indispensable, isn't it? By never giving us direct access to Yung Hai's own consciousness, Han Kang powerfully reinforces that theme of the ultimate isolation of the individual. Yung Hai remains unknowable.
Right. And it forces you, as the reader, to constantly question the reliability and maybe even the inherent selfishness of every single narrator. You only see her through their needs and perceptions.
Exactly. And the symbolism is so potent, it really sticks with you long after you finish the book. You have meat representing carnal desire, human violence, social convention, all the things she rejects. Her progressive shedding of meat, then all food, is this literal physical rejection of all those violent aspects of humanity.
And conversely, the plants, the trees, the flowers she becomes obsessed with, they symbolize the purity, the nonviolent, sessile existence she's striving for. It's this transcendent desire to become something utterly harmless.
Mm-hmm. The lasting impression of the vegetarian. It isn't really one of intellectual satisfaction, I find.
Mm.
It's more a feeling of creeping dread, a kind of claustrophobia. It completely denies easy answers. It forces us to question society's definition of normal, and it highlights the terrifying fragility of the human mind when it decides to wholly reject the demands of conformity, whatever the cost.
Ultimately, I think the novel teaches us that when society restricts every healthy avenue of expression, sometimes absolute resistance, even if it means self-destruction, can become the only form of true individual freedom left.
It really highlights the staggering, terrifying cost of that kind of autonomy. It's a profound and deeply unsettling reading experience that definitely reframes how you view silence, violence, and maybe what it even means to be human.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.